So I was in Seattle a few years ago, and it's always nice to be back. As Marty said, I'm from Boston, and we have a lot of back and forth. But we actually, at Free Speech for People, our first office was here in Seattle. And our first board member, Pamela Eakes, a founding member of Free Speech for People's board, is in the back with her wonderful family. So thank you to Pam, who does so much for us, not only here in Seattle, but all over the country. And while I'm on Seattle Connections, you'll hear about some of the work we're doing to overturn Citizens United, both with the Constitutional Amendment Campaign, work in the courts. And among the work in the courts is Seattle's defense of the minimum wage legislation that Seattle recently passed that has been sued, but has been challenged by corporations claiming a constitutional right to invalidate that minimum wage, including speech and equal protection grounds. And I think it may be the first time since the Lochner era in the last Gilded Age that the minimum wage has been attacked as a violation of a corporate constitutional right. I might be corrected by our esteemed local counsel on that, Harry Williams there, who's been a wonderful help to us in the case, but I think that's probably right. Harry has been worked very closely with our legal director, Ron Fine, in my last Seattle, shameless pandering to Seattle folks about our Seattle connections. Ron Fine, our legal director, started his career at Microsoft, and oddly enough, went to law school after a career at Microsoft, now is working closely with us all over the country in these cases and on the amendment work that is so necessary, in my view, to take on the problem in our country that Citizens United both expanded and magnified, but also in a lot of ways represents. So I guess if you'll bear with me, what I thought I might do tonight is offer a couple of propositions that come out of the Citizens United decision, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, which I think probably most everyone here knows about, as the whole country knows about, for striking down the McCain-Feingold law and the longstanding restrictions, both at the state level and federal level, on both corporations and unions spending money on elections. And my propositions that I'd offer for your consideration are I guess part one is bleak and part two is hopeful. And part one is that what Citizens United means, I think, and the new edition of the book is out. I hope you'll check it out, and 100% of royalties go to the cause. So this is not a commercial pitch so much as an explanation of why we needed a new edition only 3 years after the first one. And that goes to the heart of the first proposition I'd offer tonight, is that now, with almost 5 years of living under the Citizens United regime, I think it is accurate, sadly, to say we are faced with something of a constitutional emergency, a crisis of democracy. And that there's a reason why serious, sober people, from Bill Moyers to Jim Leach, a 30-year Republican congressman from Iowa, are using words like plutocracy to describe our system now. So I want to, that's a serious proposition, and a dire one in some ways. So I want to offer some facts to back that up. Since there are some lawyers in the room who will no doubt look for the evidence and cross-examine me, I want to offer some facts for that one. And then number two, I want to offer some facts about why, oddly enough, I think it's actually just what we needed in America. It's the wake-up call. It's going to be like a lot of times in our history when it took something like this to bring us together as a country to get back on track for a democracy. And that's the subtitle, Reclaiming Democracy from Big Money and Global Corporations. It's how we can renew this democracy. And the new edition is really about, the first edition was sort of like a rally cry, let's try to do this. This one was more fun in some ways because it's actually, I get so much inspiration because now I can describe what so many Americans actually are doing, have done, right here in Washington and all over the country, to try to do something, which is the new chapter at the end, And there's many different ways to do something, and so much has been done. So I'll share some evidence about that. You'll see, I hope, that it's not just happy talk, but there's actually a lot of work for all of us to do. So let me dive in first with the bleakness. sorry for that. Sort of dreary first part, but I think it's necessary because that's the reality. And if we can recognize it, I think we can do something. So, Citizens United, now 5 years since we have been stripped, really, of our power as citizens and people to decide and debate amongst ourselves, and then decide on what the right level of fair campaign participation of powerful entities that are, by design, aggregations of wealth and power, which are good in the economy, but not good in the political sphere. 5 years of that, what do we have to show for it? And is it really as bad as I say? Well, let me start with the numbers. We have 25 billion or so that has been spent on elections, local, state, and federal, since Citizens United. In some ways, that number is almost doesn't matter, right? Once you're into the billions, what's another billion here or there? But I think the real story of Citizens United, the McCutcheon case, the striking down of Arizona's public funding elections, a series of these 5-4 decisions which have stripped almost any ability to get a handle on this problem other than outright bribery. I think we can still have a law that says a contract to deliver cash in a bag in return for a law. That might still be within our power to prohibit, but other than that, it's pretty much open season. But the problem isn't the number, the aggregate amount. It's where it comes from. And I don't mean in an ideological sense, like, oh, it comes from, corporations, or it comes from, the right or the left. I mean how few sources it comes from. And that's why plutocracy, government of the wealthy few, is actually a description, an accurate description, not as an inflammatory kind of charge or something, but just a political science kind of description. So how few sources of this money? Well, there's different ways to look at it. Partly we don't know because of the dark money problem, but there are some things we do know. In general, about 80% of the money comes from 0.5% of the population. So 80% coming from less than 1%. Super PAC phenomenon had only just begun when the first edition came out at the beginning of 2012. We hadn't had the presidential election. So we now have some data on the super PACs that we didn't have. 32 super PAC donors contributed as much as all of the small donors to both the Romney and Obama campaigns combined. So by small donors, that means those who gave $200 or less. And there's about 3.7 million people who did that. All of that was exceeded by 32 donors to super PACs. And that's in the hundreds of millions of dollars that adds up to. So that's a problem if 32 people and corporations can just, basically nullify what the millions of people. And, think about it, 3.7 million, that's, 1% of our population? That's the small donors. That's another chilling fact, is that almost all Americans don't actually give any political money. They're completely outside of the system, either because they can't afford it, which is a real issue, or they feel so alienated by, why make a $25 contribution if Sheldon Adelson's going to make a $93 million contribution, right? And so people are rationally kind of checking out of that kind of system. So it's that concentration of very few people and sources, corporations, some unions, that are making up most of the money that is so damaging, I think, to democracy. And to, I said sober, serious people are saying things like this. I hope I hope I'm one, it's sober and serious, but I'm trying to say this is not just an argument of, from one perspective. Justice Stephen Breyer, in a dissent, is talking about the grave question of democratic legitimacy. That's from a Supreme Court justice. And a word about corporations, because after 2012, you know, there was some talk about, well, you know, corporations didn't actually give that much. Target made some contributions, and they got in, you know, people didn't like that. They got in some trouble from their customers. There was a boycott. People don't want to their, you know, places they like to shop to be playing politics in our elections. And so there was sort of this conventional wisdom that took hold in the media that, well, Citizens United, it's all been overstated. There really hasn't been much corporate money. But we can't be fooled. There's hundreds of millions of dollars of corporate money pouring into elections. And in the last week or two, we saw why it wasn't on FEC reports or anywhere else. A coding error at the Republican National Governors Association caused a series of documents to be visible on the web, which weren't supposed to be. And I'm not going to pick on the Republican Governors Association because I guarantee the same thing is happening at the Democratic Governors Association, but they have better coders, I guess. The documents showed Microsoft, Pfizer, Walmart, Comcast, Shell, Verizon, Chrysler, Archer Daniels Midland, many more. It was like the Fortune 500 were all there, giving hundreds of thousands of dollars for access to the governors, but more importantly, you know, in regular intervals. So this is, we're talking millions and millions of dollars being run through these associations, which then go out and spend it in the election. So you can read all the time or hear about, oh, the Republican National Governors Association is coming into Washington with a $5 million ad attack. Well, where do you think they get the $5 million? It's funneled through. And same with the Democratic Governors Association. Same with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That's where the corporate money's coming in, and it's coming in very large amounts. So that's something we now know that, you know, that wasn't clear. There was some talk after Citizens United, well, corporations won't really do this. Well, that's not true. It's happening. So what about the a few more numbers for you? And my colleague at Free Speech for People, John Bonifaz, who co-founded this organization and leads it, had a phrase for this that has now been taken up much more widely. He called it the wealth primary. That essentially almost all Americans, literally, we're up to about, you know, 90-something percent who don't participate in this wealth primary, they're excluded from what is currently the most crucial phase of defining who the candidates are going to be, what the issues we're going to talk about, more importantly, what we're not going to talk about, what are the issues that are going to be debated. That wealth primary, he compares it to the old Texas white primary, where they in the segregation days, Jim Crow laws, and they had a sort of unofficial white primary where all the candidates were decided, and that was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. That's why we believe this system is unconstitutional. It's not just wrong. It's not just damaging. It's a violation of the fundamental principle of political equality in this country. So. I mentioned Sheldon Adelson. It'll be my last sort of talk about the money problem. But he gave $93 million through super PACs in the last election. So he's back, getting ready for 2016, and he's auditioning presidential candidates. They're all coming to see him and perform. And because he has $93 million, he has a lot more, actually. So if they haven't come by your house to talk about what they plan on in 2016, you just need $93 million and they'll be there. So it was Molly Ball in The Atlantic, a reporter at The Atlantic, attended one of these, and she described it in something I can't help sharing with you as the Sheldon Adelson suck-up fest. And these are people who might be our president, right? The Sheldon Adelson suck-up fest in which the candidates quoting Molly Ball, like the daughters of King Lear or the cast of Mean Girls, each sought to outdo the others in his fawning. I mean, this is what we've come to. Open, embarrassing fawning in front of billionaires to decide, you know, who's going to be a serious, quote-unquote, presidential candidate and who isn't. So I said state, federal, and local races, and I think that's the other thing that now we know we live under after Citizens United is this happens even in local races. And Chevron Corporation, just to cite one example, spent $1.3 million in a city council race in a community of 100,000 people in Richmond, California, where they have a refinery. And had some problems because the refinery blew up and sent 15,000 Richmond citizens to the hospital for breathing problems. And so they could have fixed the refinery or they could have fixed the council. They chose the latter and spent $1.3 million to do that. I talked to the mayor, Gail McLaughlin, and she tells me they're back this year with $2 million in a city council race in a community of 100,000 people. That's disenfranchisement. That's the Citizens United problem, is it's disenfranchising ordinary and almost all American citizens now. And that's really the heart of the problem. It's as if the court has injected a new proposition into the Constitution that's really counter to the fundamental proposition that we have and that we started with as a country and that we're going to finish with and keep going, which is that we actually are all created equal, that we do have equal political rights, even if we don't have the same economic resources or anything like that. We come to the ballot box and we come through being represented with equality. And that's what Citizens United is upending. And so I want to emphasize how intentional that actually is. I mean, I tell the story of Citizens United started, but it's almost now explicit that, yes, of course political equality is dead and over. They actually almost say that. I want to just share a paragraph, and it's a short one, don't worry. It's from a law brief, but it's a pretty clear assertion, essentially, that political equality in America is not a basis for our election laws. And so they say in the McCutcheon case, I don't know if you all follow the Sean McCutcheon is a CEO of a coal engineering firm, and he was feeling like his free speech rights were violated because the federal law still, even after Citizens United, said you can't give more than $123,000 to aggregate campaigns of federal candidates. You know, there's still contribution limits so far. We'll see what happens in the next case. But so you can give $2,600 to federal candidates for Congress or what have you. But there's a law that said you can't give them all over the country and basically buy a party and an entire Congress. You got to stop at $123,000 because otherwise it's systemically corrupting. And there's a lot of good reasons for it. But he said, no, I want to do unlimited contributions all across the country to every race. I don't care if they don't represent me. I want to have my influence across with the board with my money. He won the case. That law was struck down. There is no more aggregate limit. And bear in mind, 123,000 is about five times the median earnings of Americans. You know, we often hear $50,000 as median household income. That's actually double because that assumes two earners in the household. It's about $26,000 for median income. So this is five times the median income struck down as a violation of free speech rights. And the argument was the following. Sorry, I should find it first before I say I'm going to read it to you. We have this quote from the McCutcheon brief. Contribution limits may not be upheld as a means of limiting disparities in the extent to which people of different economic backgrounds are able to participate in the political process and exercise their First Amendment rights. So, you know, one of the tasks of a lawyer is to translate legalese, but I'm not sure that one needs any translating. It's, they're saying that we can't have laws to allow people of different economic backgrounds to participate in the political process. In other words, if you don't have the money to play, too bad. You're out. That's what they argued, and they won based on that argument. So this is the kind of explicit theory that Citizens United is now offering us and that we're living under, which is, you know, we are government of the wealthy few, and that's how it should be. They don't deny that. They say that's the way it is, and it's too bad. You may have heard recently about the Benjamin Page, Martin Gillen study at Princeton Northwestern. They did a comprehensive study of the influence of affluence, as they called it. And it's basically about how does policy actually get determined in Washington? Who has influence? And it was a big, rich data source they looked at. And their conclusion is the following. And then I won't be so bleak for so long, but just a little bit more, if you can stand it. The estimated impact of average citizens' preferences is non-significant, near zero. Ordinary citizens, quoting the study, have little or no independent influence on policy at all. Economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while mass-based interest groups and average citizens have little or no independent influence. So that, I would think, would be a wake-up call. We'd all rush to say we don't want, can't be a government of the wealthy few. That look what's happening. The Manhattan Institute, which is a well-funded institute, responded and said, "It's no story here. This isn't a problem." They essentially argued that rich people are better informed, vote more often, and generally reflect the views of the middle class anyway. So we don't really have a problem here. So this is what we're now doing, is sort of justifying and saying, yeah, it's not so bad. This is the way it should be. Wealthy people are funding politics, but what's the problem? Well, the problem is, A, it's not American. It's not what our Constitution is about. And B, it's how republics and countries and societies fail. You know, we see it over and over again. We've seen it in our own country. The last time the court went down this road of money rights and corporate rights was between 1886 and about 1930, and it was a social, constitutional, and economic catastrophe, which we didn't recover from until a new judiciary got back on track with where the courts belong and where the people belong. And then that was the last Gilded Age, and I think what we're having now and what Citizens United stands for is our second, even stronger, Gilded Age, where we have to respond. It is a crisis. Democracy is on the line. And the money isn't even the least of it. As I mentioned, a tax on the minimum wage is an equal protection right violation. A tax on the right of employees to even talk about workplace conditions and whether to organize, struck down the notice that they were supposed to be given of that right, struck down as a violation of a corporate right not to speak. The country of origin labels for meat, so you could decide if you wanted to support American farmers, struck down, violation of corporate speech rights. The Seattle case I mentioned, the St. Louis, we had a case in St. Louis where 30,000 people in St. Louis signed to have a municipal ballot about whether their tax dollars would continue to be used by the city to be taken by the tax from the taxpayers and given directly to Peabody Energy, which is headquartered in St. Louis. They were getting a tax subsidy. There was a campaign called Take Back St. Louis to say we need a more resilient local economy. We can't be continuing to pour more and more of our tax money, hoping that company will, you know, fossil fuel company will stay. We have to build our economy from the ground up, the middle out. We want a different way. We're going to vote on whether to continue this. Well, that vote was blocked. So not only did the policy not get changed, they weren't allowed to vote on it. They were sued. It was taken off the ballot, violation of equal protection rights of the corporation because it chose fossil fuel companies and picked on poor Peabody Energy. And they were denied the right to vote. Even though at that time, the city allowed municipal ballot initiatives like this, blocked by the courts. About the same time, the Missouri legislature virtually overnight passed a special law that applied only to St. Louis, only to fossil fuel companies, that said municipal citizens' ballot initiatives can't address those kind of issues. So that was sort of the 1-2 punch of in the courts and the money influence in the legislature to essentially strip people of even the right to vote on whether their tax dollars are going to be spent. So that's the kind of problem we have. So what do we do about it? The beauty of it is, I think, the beauty, if you can call it that, the inspiration I find is people get it across the political spectrum. This isn't a left issue or a right issue, and people are doing something. So let me tell you how that's working. And the way I see it is we have a choice. We're sort of in this vicious circle of we lose our political voice, we lose our political equality. We don't get to participate because it's now a money game. We get attacked by the cynical attack ads. I mean, overwhelmed by them. Our government doesn't function very well, and we check out. You know, voters don't vote. People don't do the things that citizenship requires of all of us as much. And that's sort of the vicious circle of how we can fail. But there's a virtuous circle, I think, that is going too, where people are trying something. They introduce a resolution calling for a 28th Amendment. They actually do a protest or call a city councilor or a congressperson. And they start to do something, and then they find out other people are doing it too, and they might win a resolution or get a disclosure law or make a little progress, and you start to see a virtuous circle where we can actually turn this around and not only turn the policy around and the constitutional law around, but actually reengage Americans across the partisan lines to believe, again, that we can be a government of the people. And so I want to just share with you the constitutional amendment story because it's in some ways the hardest. You know, the people would tell you, oh, the 28th Amendment, you know, we can't do constitutional amendments. How long will it take? It's, you know, that's impossible. And so when the book first came out, there was one state that had passed a constitutional amendment resolution calling for the 28th Amendment to overturn Citizens United and restore the power of the people to decide for ourselves on the right campaign finance laws to ensure fair and free elections and the human rights of people, not corporations, in our Constitution. One state, there was a handful of towns and cities that had passed resolutions. I think we had, Pam might remember, one or two senators who would talk to us about a constitutional amendment, a couple of congresspeople. So where are we now, 3 years later? 36 months later, 16 states have passed resolutions calling for a 28th Amendment. 600 cities and towns. Yeah, that's good news. 600 cities and towns have done this. I'm from New England. We have town meetings for our government. Literally, every citizen in Concord, where I'm from, is effectively a legislature. We have an open town meeting. Sometimes it's endless, 3 days, three nights of school budgets and everything else. Well, we had one on the Citizens United 28th Amendment and, you know, debate of the issue, what it meant, and the town meeting voted, and it was about 80%, you know, and I looked around. People I knew were conservatives, liberals, everyone in between. We're standing together on this. That happened over and over again all over New England. 47 town meetings in 1 week in New Hampshire. Conservative towns in New Hampshire did this. All over New England, people were doing this, and all over the country, people have done this, whether through city councils, whether through town meetings. And that is the transformative, the sort of virtuous circle that can happen when people are actually acting like we are, which is citizens in our republic, taking responsibility, standing up. And, you know, I quote some folks in the book who've never done anything political, and they were nervous and scared. You know, how do you stand up in front of a city council when you maybe haven't even gone to a city council meeting before and introduce a resolution or demand a resolution to change constitutional law? I mean, that can be intimidating, but people do it. And I talked about some of them in the book, and they say, yeah, I was scared, but I did it. I stood up, and it was so powerful to see the support I got, people I didn't know would support me, and it passed by 80%, whatever, and they are empowered. And that is what the amendment can do. So 16 states, 600 cities and towns. Is Congress listening? You bet. We now have 55 senators who've co-sponsoring the 28th Amendment, the Democracy for All Amendment, which overturns the big money part of Citizens United and says we can actually distinguish between corporations and people on campaign finance laws. 55 senators co-sponsoring it. We did something in 2014 that people said it wouldn't happen in our lifetimes. We got through the Senate Judiciary Committee with a vote of approval, went to the Senate floor, had a debate, won 55-42, which of course you know you don't win anymore in Washington with 55 votes. And for a constitutional amendment, we will need 67 votes. It takes two-thirds. But that's 12 more. And so we're going to keep doing what we've been doing, and we're going to get those 12. It gets harder, but I think we have to believe we can do this, and we will. On the House side, we're probably at about 130, 140 co-sponsors. So we are winning this debate. We are right on the issue. Americans are with us, and this is happening. Let me just sort of close on the amendment story with Montana, because I think that's where people really saw with the power. You know, we've got a legal program. We're in the courts, as I mentioned. We went to Montana and worked with the Attorney General there, Steve Bullock, to defend the 1912 Montana ballot initiative that had said no corporate money in our elections. Because in 1912, the last Gilded Age, Montana took a stand to protect their democracy. After Citizens United, of course, it was attacked. We helped defend it. The Supreme Court, as you probably know, said, gave Montana the back of the hand, all the other states, and said, no, Citizens United applies. You can't do that anymore. And 5-4, two Supreme Court justices actually said, we should overturn Citizens United today. It was Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Breyer. That's remarkable for a Supreme Court justice only that soon after a case to say we're not standing together with the court. We should overturn that decision. But that wasn't the end of the story. People in Montana said, no, we're not just going home because the Supreme Court told us to. Within a few weeks, 44,000 people in Montana signed a ballot initiative, signed a petition to put this on the ballot. It not only called for the 28th Amendment, it condemned Citizens United. It went into details about the policy of Montana's based on the equality in our politics of all Americans and level playing field, and that corporations do not have the human rights of people in our Constitution. And then it did, I guess what maybe you do it in Seattle too, if folks out west do, which it didn't ask or demand, it instructed their representatives to get the 28th Amendment out of Congress and to the states for ratification. So Montana, that was on the ballot in November 2012. Montana, 10 points went for Mitt Romney easily, and so Mitt Romney won the state easily. This ballot initiative passed 75% to 25% in Montana. The same day, ballot initiative passed in Colorado, 75%, 25%. That's how we got to 16 states. Hard work of ordinary Americans who just aren't going to sit back and watch our democracy die. I think we can win these in any state in the country. I don't think this is red state, blue state. And if we carry it to the country, we'll keep that virtuous circle going. So the amendment isn't the only thing. There's a lot of really important reform, but the amendment is a vehicle to pull us together as a country, to stand on the basic principles that the country is built on, and to build the rationale and the momentum and the organization to get disclosure, to get campaign finance limits that make sense, to get things like not only transparency, but just things like corporate money shouldn't be in our elections, to get corporate law reform so that we actually can hardwire effective corporations. And many, all of us work or live or invest and have family members work in corporations. It's not that they're bad people. We know that. It's whether we are organizing them effectively, not only in election laws, but in corporate laws, so that we can do what we want to do with corporations, which is bring together capital and labor and ideas to build not only great products, but a great economy and society. There's a lot of really good things happening with around benefit corporations and other responsible corporations. And this amendment, this conversation that we can bring across the country helps drive all of that forward. And so I know we can do this. We are doing it. I hope you'll check out the book. and find out how you can plug in if you're not already involved. And I know there's some folks here in the room who have been involved in this here in Washington and across the country, but there's a lot of different ways you can get involved, different organizations, they're all in the book, to try to do something and bring this country together in a way that overturns Citizens United, moves us forward. And I like to look at history, and I'll just close with that, because we've been here before. You know, we've gotten through these kind of crises, and we come out the other side with a vibrant, healthy democracy. And it's not easy, but we do it. And so we have to ask ourselves, if we can't do it, you know, what's wrong with our generation? Because previous generations did it. And you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with our generation, which is why we're seeing this happening. We're doing it. So you know, Winston Churchill said, he loved America. His mother was American. And he said, Americans always do the right thing after exhausting all the other possibilities. So we've exhausted the other possibilities. We're going to do the right thing. And I'll close with Abraham Lincoln, who called for the 13th Amendment to end slavery in 1862. It was a year before he did the Emancipation Proclamation. And he knew that the forces against him were huge. And it was difficult. It was challenging. It was taking on immense power. But that it was right. And what he said is really telling, I think. He said it's not enough to imagine better. It's not enough to think anew. He said we have to act better. We have to act anew. He said we have to disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. And I think that's what moments like this do. That's the not only a silver lining, but sort of the message, the destination that we see in the sort of darkness of the plutocracy side. We see that call for Abraham Lincoln that we must not only imagine what a democracy looks like, but do it to make it happen. And so what gives me hope is not just the great words, it's that was the 13th Amendment. We're at 28. We've done 14 since then. 7 of them overturned Supreme Court decisions. The Supreme Court said women had no right to vote. The Supreme Court said we're not allowed to have a federal income tax. The Supreme Court said 18, 19, and 20-year-olds fine to go off to Vietnam and die, but no right to vote. The Supreme Court said poll taxes that don't let the poor vote or African Americans get to the polls in the South, nothing wrong with that. Constitutional amendment overturned that. Over and over and over again, we use this tool when the chips are down, and I think we can do it too. So thank you very much. Great to be here with you in Seattle. And maybe there's some questions and conversation we can have. So thanks. Any questions? Yeah, no. Well, you know, I talk in the book about Lewis Powell, actually. There's a few Virginians here and a few Washington and Lee alums, I think, maybe. But Lewis Powell was a corporate lawyer, a Virginian. And I don't think he would say I'm a plutocrat, but I think he was concerned about kind of democracy run amok, as he saw it, in the 1960s, where we actually did 4 amendments in 10 years between 1961 and 1971. And I think in the Powell memo, where he sort of outlined the game plan for the chamber, it wasn't plutocracy, but it was, you know, wealthy interests and corporations have a need for stability and order. And, you know, we can have a bit of that by spending a whole lot of money and changing our court and our democracy. But I think there's, I want to be take the spirit of the question and not just make it easy and say, no, those plutocrats. These are hard cases. I mean, cases don't get to the Supreme Court unless they're very complicated and difficult. You know, 5-4 smart Supreme Court justices disagree, and they're not malevolent or evil, I don't think. They're difficult questions that are driven by the precedent that kind of focuses in a particular time. And I think what happened in Citizens United was the facts are difficult. And there's an old saying among lawyers that hard facts make bad law, you know, hard cases make bad law. And that's what happened, I think, because in Citizens United, you had citizens who were organized and used a nonprofit vehicle to criticize, through a movie, Hillary Clinton, who was going to run for president. So on those facts, that sounds like everything I hope we would all want to make sure happens, is that people can criticize powerful senators who are running for president. And so the majority would say, look, there's just no way to get the right amount of regulation on money. It's going to suppress speech. You're not going to let people criticize powerful politicians, and that's wrong. That's the First Amendment says we have a right to do that. So I think that is what their argument is that, you know, if we try to limit money in politics and do this constitutional amendment, Ted Cruz on the Senate floor, I mentioned the Senate debate, he said Saturday Night Live actors would go off to jail, people like Tina Fey, because she made fun of Sarah Palin. That's the kind of, you know, carnival extreme of the argument. You know, Saturday Night Live hastened to say, no, we won it, and we're not worried about that. But, you know, there's a concern that somehow if we let Congress regulate spending in elections, they're going to come for all of us. So that's sort of the main defense. But to me, I think it's really a preference for deregulation that we could decide, in my view. After the amendment, we could actually say, oh, yeah, let's just have unlimited money in elections. The amendment doesn't prevent that. But I don't think for a second that Americans actually think that's a good way to save a democracy. And I think it's up to the people to decide that right level, where you're not choosing like one side or the other. They're just even-handed regulations. But it gets tricky, and I think that's to be fair to the other side, their arguments would say, well, that you're going to suppress freedom of speech if you limit spending in elections. They probably would do a more robust defense than that, but that's the outline of it, I think. What else? Yes, sir. Well, I got a good book for you. No, I know, Haley. You've read the first one, but I do tell the story of Montana that I touched on today, because to me, it was a model for exactly how we go forward. We helped in Montana. We worked with Common Cause, Free Speech for People, to get this. And we were ready because we did the case. We knew what the court was going to go the direction they did. The day the decision was announced, we had a video of Governor Schweitzer, Brian Schweitzer, he's a Democrat, and John Bollinger, the lieutenant governor, he's a Republican. They stood together in the video and said, the Supreme Court has just eviscerated our law in Montana. We need a constitutional amendment. We don't agree on politics, but we agree on this. That set the tone. We had business support, ranchers, farmers, you know, business people all across Montana. And so it wasn't like us coming in from Boston to say, oh, let us tell you what you need in Montana. It was Montanans having a debate and a conversation, and conservatives able to express themselves in the way they wanted to express themselves. Bishop Judith Crist, Bishop of the Montana, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Montana, did op-eds and papers across the country that said this isn't a partisan issue. It's a justice issue. It's a faith issue. And you had that kind of dialogue where people across the spectrum of politics were given a means of expressing themselves about the problem of money and corporate power in our society. And we didn't have, you know, we weren't trying to like wordsmith it for them. And I think that's the power of the amendment. It's you don't get into the weeds on policy differences. Instead, it's a conversation about who we are as a country. Do we defend the principle of political equality or not? Do we mean it when we said all are created equal or not in politics? And I think most Americans say, yeah, we mean it. And if we give them the vehicle, like these amendment resolutions or other means to come together and have the debate and the conversation, then that's the virtuous circle. Then they realize, oh, you know, that person I've been screaming at about Obamacare or climate change actually is a fellow citizen who cares as much about the country as I do. Maybe there's something here. So I think there's no shortcut. It's hard. I think it's like self-government is hard. Democracy's hard. Citizenship's hard. But if we give these opportunities for Americans to participate in this national debate, national conversation, we'll see how they do it. And they did it in Montana that way. And I've seen it in other places where they don't have the same words sometimes. I was surprised that democracy isn't always the favorite word on the right. They are concerned that we're a republic, you know, they have a meaningful distinction there, and it's well grounded in history and our Constitution. And so, you know, we can learn from each other, and we have a lot of shared basic principles that actually I think are coming out. That's the path forward I see. And if we try to jump too far ahead and say, I found the perfect law or I found the perfect campaign finance reform, let me convince you that it's right, that's harder to do. until you've had that grounding conversation that shows why you actually both might see why that particular legislation might be good, or that we can tweak it so to make it work for everybody. Yeah, let me go here because you had your hand up, and then I'll go that way. Yes, sir. Yes, great question, and it's a fascinating story. So he's referring to a case out of West Virginia called Caperton versus Massey, I think, right? And the Massey is Massey Energy, Massey Coal Company, and they had a $50 million judgment against them for illegal business practices in the trial courts, and they were going up on appeal to the Supreme Court of West Virginia. And the CEO of Massey, a gentleman named Don Blankenship, created a group, quote unquote, I think he was the group, called For Our Kids' Sake, and put $3 million, I think, into it. And they ran attack ads. They elect their justices in West Virginia. They elect the Supreme Court. They ran attack ads against the judges that he thought would be a problem for Massey on appeal in this $50 million case. Saying that they were essentially soft on child molesters and other criminals, and for the sake of our kids, we have to get these bad judges out. Attack ads in a judicial election, unfortunately, have since Citizens United become sadly common, but they were unusual then. He didn't just do that. He got a friend to run against them, so he would have a friend who would be a Supreme Court justice, and he funded that campaign too. And lo and behold, the distinguished jurist on the West Virginia Supreme Court got defeated as a child hater and criminal lover, and Don Blankenship's friend got elected. So that went, the company, oh, of course, what happened when it went up on appeal. Well, the Massey verdict got voided. They said overturned the trial court, and it was by one vote, it was Massey's, Don Blankenship's friend cast the vote that overturned the verdict. So the strategy worked. Spend $3 million, save $50 million. So a $47 million benefit for spending $3 million. That went up on appeal to the Supreme Court as a violation of the due process rights of the other side, who said, this is injustice. He bought a judge. He threw out our verdict. This, finally, the court saw something that was just too much, even for the Supreme Court. And the fascinating thing, though, was it's Caperton versus Massey. The Supreme Court said West Virginia, that kind of spending in elections did violate the due process clause, sent it back to the judge should have recused himself, the legal word. The judge, who was Massey's friend, should not have cast that last vote and let the rest of the justices decide. So it went back to West Virginia. Here's the really interesting thing, is that decision was written by Justice Kennedy, the same judge who wrote Citizens United. And so it did make a lot of people, including us at Free Speech for People, see this as, well, maybe there's an opportunity here. Even Justice Kennedy does see a corruption in spending when it's, well, someone like him, a judge. You know, maybe we can persuade him that there's, you know, the same concern in when it's not justices, but all of us is trying to manage a self-government. I don't think we'll get that. I don't think we tried with Montana, which was actually after. Justice Kennedy had a chance to say, maybe I made a mistake, and he just chose not to. But the strategies we're looking at now are in the states where there are judicial elections, which is to bring a challenge based on Caperton to the spending, which has gone up through the roof in states. Do you elect judges here in Washington State? Yeah. So, and there's some cases coming in the next term that will consider this, and we're going to do a brief in the case and try to, you know, basically Caperton and Citizens United are kind of at odds. There's a bit of tension there, and that's an opportunity to potentially move the law a little bit. So, yes, Lou. Yeah, that's a great point, and I don't disagree. I disagree on respectfully on the constitutional amendment's value in driving that debate. I think we're having increasingly a debate about the court, and what the amendment movement does is invite Americans to participate in that. It can't, you know, FDR didn't do that in isolation. I mentioned the last Gilded Age of corporate power and corporate rights in the Constitution. The reason the Supreme Court was striking down the New Deal legislation was based on the precedent that had gone back to 1886. And so that was at the tail end. There were amendment fights. The Supreme Court had struck down child labor laws, had struck down worker safety laws. There was a child labor amendment movement. They did four amendments in that era before the New Deal to overturn the Supreme Court's decision on the progressive income tax, to overturn the Supreme Court's decision that said women can't vote, and to elect senators for the first time. And then there was prohibition. We won't talk about that one. But my view isn't that the amendment is the cure-all or the magic, and or that we shouldn't talk about the Supreme Court. I think you're absolutely right. That's a very good strategy. But the context of that strategy, I think, fits with a nation that is engaged, whether it's the amendment movement, whether it's corporate law reform, but this insistence that the court has to stop vetoing, essentially, small d democratic laws. So I think the 1937 court packing battle was that you didn't need an amendment by the time that was done. But that didn't just happen as the magic bullet either. It's because for years people had been fighting. So I think we need to do all of them. And I do think a debate about the Supreme Court is overdue. And there are more and more people talking about it. I, in a bit of tongue-in-cheek, sent out something when the Supreme Court came back first Monday in October. A poll came out the same day that said 70% of Americans want term limits on the Supreme Court. So I think the debate is on, and I think we should drive it forward as much as we can. Thank you. Yeah, straight over here. Wow. It's a great question. I've got three millennials, not at home anymore. They're out and checked out, too. No, I don't know if they're checked out, but I know exactly what you're talking about. It's been a tough time to grow up. 9/11, the crash, the takeover of our democracy by money, climate catastrophe that seems nobody's willing to do anything about it. And so I get it. I don't think, the father of millennials is the one who's going to give you the answers. I think it's got to come from you, actually. And what inspires me about your generation is there's a totally hypersensitive BS meter. you guys don't buy anything on its face. You know how to find the facts online, so you don't fall for slogans. And that's, I think, really hopeful. And it's disruptive, to use the cliche. Especially in Seattle, I shouldn't use that, I guess. That's probably what was invented. It's so old-fashioned now, probably, to say disruptive. But it's disruptive, and I think you're seeing good things coming out of that. You're seeing an interesting libertarian kind of conversation happening on the right among millennials. You're seeing on the left some interesting, Zephyr Teachout isn't a millennial, but she was supported by a lot of millennials and challenging Mario Cuomo, governor of New York, who had gazillions of dollars and high poll ratings, but who turned his back on campaign finance reform by gutting what was called the Moorhead Commission to look into corruption. Andrew Cuomo. Did I say Mario? Yes, yes. He was the good Cuomo. This is Andrew Cuomo, the son, the younger. Sorry, Mario. I was a big fan of Mario Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo, thank you. And so I think there's no reverence for, the Democratic Party. We can't do a primary against governor. They did it. So I think the answer is up to you in the end. But what gives me hope, and both my own kids and others I see, is the fact you're here. Thank you. And I know you won't take anything I say with, he's got the answer. Great, let's go do that. You'll check it out and find your own way, because you check out of certain things and find engagement in other ways, I think. And the political process hasn't exactly been a welcoming place to participate for a lot of younger people. But I think I would urge, find your way to check in a way that makes sense and is effective for you, because they're there. And you see it in some of the different groups I mentioned, Represent Us, and some of the Larry Lessig supporters come from a younger cohort, and again has no reverence for the old ways of doing things, and they're trying different ideas, Mayday Pack and different things. They're trying things, and I think that's something, is you don't give up when something doesn't work. You reconfigure and try again. So let me know what you come up with. And you know, there's a lot of different, you know, politics isn't the only way, you know, there's economic innovations, there's social innovations, there's lots of innovations happening. The whole sharing economy thing, I think, is very hopeful that, you know, you guys just seem to get and plug in and it works. And so there's a lot of different ways I think we'll see positive change come out of your generation that maybe even makes you not be saddled with debt with no, you know, low wages and all the and the climate horrors, but actually has a much better society all around. So I that's a long-winded way of saying I don't have any magic answer, but I see different signs of hope and ways that will be effective for you guys. Yeah, right behind you. Yeah, so I'm trying to avoid a treatise. yeah, so the, you know, the Commerce Clause gives Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce, and it was one of the very important reasons for the Constitution. So the states didn't begin erecting all kinds of barriers to national commerce. It was thought important to help this country come together as a nation and then have effective nationwide commerce. And the Supreme Court came up with a little innovation. Well, the Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce, but then sort of like penumbras and emanations that they talk about sometime, they came up with something called the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is sort of a doctrine that says even though Congress hasn't regulated anything, we sort of on the court have a good idea about, you know, a state or local regulation that somehow is violating the dormant, just sort of like the double secret commerce clause, you know, that and says states and communities can't do that because it infringes the sort of national commerce idea. There's some basis for that in some instances, but it gets out of control, I think, sometimes, and it disempowers states and communities. There was just to give one example that I think brings it back to facts and instead of up in the sky with law, California passed a law saying that eggs sold in California had to come from chickens with a certain amount of space in the cage. They were trying to do something about factory farming that many people think is wrong and unhealthy and dangerous. You need more antibiotics. It has all kinds of reasons why they thought California is going to have a different system and you know, have standards for human health, not just the concern about chickens, but for human health. Well, they were sued by the industrial egg producers, other words, saying this violates the Commerce Clause. We can't sell our eggs in California, and you're making us change our practices, even though we don't, you know, we're not in California, in order to sell eggs in California. That was a Commerce Clause case. In that one, California won. The law was upheld, but then sometimes they don't. So there's a lot of constitutional issues. I think that a lot of this comes down to sort of to the role of the courts and how much are we actually allowed to experiment with democracy, try different things, have different states try something, have the laboratories of democracy without sort of a judicial enforcement of a particular point of view or policy. And the danger of the Commerce Clause is it sometimes becomes a tool for a particular vision of kind of global capitalism, even though many Americans have different ideas they want to try. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Marty. Thank you, Jeff.